Good morning and welcome to the Daily Digest from Personalized Intelligence. Sunday, April 19th, and this is our Macro Geopolitics AI Blockchain Edition, packed as always. I'm Maya.
And I'm Alex. And Maya, before we even get packed, let's just say the tectonic plates of the global order are shifting faster than ever.
A bit dramatic, don't you think? But you're right. We're kicking off with a look at how geopolitical tensions are rewriting the rules of global energy security and who's holding all the cards.
And we'll explore how AI isn't just automating tasks, it's triggering a full-blown enterprise revolution, almost like a controlled experiment where software is the variable constantly being tweaked for maximum disruption.
Okay, now you're being dramatic. But it is huge. And speaking of disruption, Alex, did you see the latest figures on credit delinquency rates? They're higher than anyone predicted.
Worryingly so. We'll unpack the financial system stress, the risks bubbling in both credit and real estate. And as always, we'll finish with crypto, because while the price of Bitcoin gets all the headlines, the regulatory hurdles and ecosystem vulnerabilities are a far more pressing story.
And trust me, there's a vulnerability you haven't heard about yet. It's going to change how you think about decentralized finance. Let's dive in. Jamie Smyth said the Iran war created a substantial physical shortage of oil, impacting 20% of global supply. Let's talk about geopolitics and global energy security, specifically how quickly things can fall apart when you have a real-world disruption, not just a price spike.
That figure is critical, Maya. It's not comparable to the Russia-Ukraine situation, which primarily impacted markets through financial instruments and trade adjustments. We're talking about a tangible lack of supply, roughly 40% of the world's oil and LNG trade routes choked off by the Strait of Hormuz blockage. That's unprecedented, as Smyth put it.
Right, substantial and unprecedented. Industry jargon for we're all screwed if this lasts. What's the baseline scenario here? Everyone wants to reopen the strait, but what realistically does that look like?
The core issue is the U.S. and Iran both expressing willingness, but the devil, unsurprisingly, is in the details. Scott Sheffield, with his experience in Iran in the 60s, negotiating in the Tehran Bazaar of all places, advocates for a joint international force. His background seems to inform a pragmatic view of needing direct engagement, even with a challenging regime.
Negotiating in a bazaar sounds intense. So Sheffield thinks a multinational police force is the answer. Doesn't that just escalate things?
It's less about a police force and more about creating a secure corridor for shipping. He believes a coordinated effort, drawing on regional players, is the only way to de-risk the situation. Mike Summers, the API head, reportedly privately advocated for boots on the ground too, demonstrating a surprising consensus within the industry on forceful intervention.
Boots on the ground. Another wonderfully vague phrase. Let's translate NATO troops potentially engaging in direct conflict in the Persian Gulf.
That's Sheffield's specific anticipation, NATO involvement to prevent Iran from controlling the strait. He explicitly forecasts that possibility. It shifts the conversation from simply easing tensions to a concrete escalation scenario.
Okay, so even the US, the world's biggest oil producer, isn't immune. We're hearing reports of higher gas prices despite domestic production. Explain that.
US energy independence, achieved through the shale revolution, doesn't guarantee protection from global shocks. Asian markets are aggressively purchasing available U.S. oil to compensate for the Iranian shortfall. This makes the U.S. a key absorber and redistributor of the effect, raising domestic prices, a clear demonstration of interconnectedness.
So we're basically a giant energy buffer, soaking up the damage and passing the costs on to consumers. That feels suboptimal.
Essentially, it highlights the fallacy of thinking energy independence equates to complete isolation. The global market forces still exert considerable influence.
Brian Sheffield brings up Venezuela. What's the thinking there? A regime change suddenly makes it a viable option.
The argument is that Venezuela has existing infrastructure capable of boosting production relatively quickly. Both President Trump and American companies are showing interest, and Brian Sheffield predicts U.S. oil reserves are dwindling, necessitating overseas exploration. It's a strategic necessity to avoid relying solely on shale, challenging the narrative of sustained U.S. energy dominance.
Right, a quick fix using a country we spend decades sanctioning. Strategic necessity is a convenient term for geopolitical pragmatism.
The implication runs deeper. The Trump administration's renewed interest is significant. It suggests a willingness to overlook past issues in pursuit of energy security.
What about renewables? Is this war accelerating the energy transition, as some are suggesting?
It's a secondary effect. The conflict has prompted governments globally to prioritize homegrown energy sources. Renewables and nuclear are receiving renewed focus, but the 80% reliance on fossil fuels means a complete shift will take considerable time.
So it's more of a polite nod to sustainability while scrambling for more oil.
Something to flag here, it's a long-term goal being accelerated by a short-term crisis, but the fundamental dependence on fossil fuels remains.
Let's talk about trade disruption. The numbers from Daybreak Weekend are pretty stark, a drop from 150 ships per day to 5 to 10. What's being disrupted besides oil?
It's far more widespread than just crude. We're seeing shortages of refined products, LNG, LPG, fertilizers, and even metals. That disruption, affecting roughly 40% of the world's oil and LNG trade, extends the impact far beyond the Middle East.
So it's not just filling up your gas tank that's affected, it's potentially global agricultural supply chains too.
And the BOJ is anticipating an increase in their inflation outlook because of these energy prices. The war is contributing to rising inflation in Europe and Japan, impacting company performance, particularly in the luxury sector.
Okay, so even high-end consumers are feeling the pinch. What about the monetary policy side of things? The Fed is getting a lot of attention.
The initial hawkish reaction to the oil price shock is shifting. Global Datapod highlights a counterintuitive dynamic. Strong U.S. job growth, averaging over 100,000 per month, is seen as a catalyst for potential tightening, overshadowing fears about the oil shock.
That feels backwards. Shouldn't a potential oil shock encourage dovish policy?
That's the point. If the economy proves resilient despite higher energy prices, the Fed may prioritize inflation concerns. They're becoming less worried about the shock because they're seeing stronger employment data.
So strong jobs report equals higher rates, even with a war raging that's disrupting global oil supply.
That's the emerging consensus, according to Kasman and Lupton. It highlights the importance of correctly identifying the source of the shock, demand versus supply. Attributing price increases to demand alters the macroeconomic interpretation.
What about the emerging markets? Are sovereign wealth funds pulling back from investments in the region?
Surprisingly, no. Despite the conflict, Middle Eastern sovereign wealth funds continue to actively deploy capital into global investments, particularly in private markets. HSBC sees the region as a long-term wealth management hub, and the London Stock Exchange is experiencing strong transaction volume since 2005.
So they're essentially doubling down.
It reveals a long-term investment horizon not immediately deterred by geopolitical instability. They're willing to absorb short-term risks for long-term gains.
Let's pull it together. We've got a physical oil shortage, potential military intervention, a renewed focus on Venezuela, and a surprisingly resilient emerging market investment landscape. What's the biggest unanswered question here?
The duration and scope of the Strait of Hormuz blockage. The analysts are anticipating a relatively quick reopening. Kasman and Lupton predict a modest energy price shock, but the willingness of both the U.S. and Iran to engage is far from guaranteed. The precise conditions for reopening, and whether a joint international force Sheffield's proposal becomes reality, remains the critical unknown. It's the single biggest determinant of the long-term impact on global growth and energy security.
We're getting a lot of signals about risk management and contingency planning, but no clear answer on how this standoff actually ends. And that perhaps is the most unsettling part. This entire discussion underscores the potential for a swift, dramatic realignment of supply chains and investment priorities. It suggests that the infrastructure we're building for AI's enterprise revolution and the software powering it may need to incorporate entirely new geopolitical realities far faster than previously anticipated. You know what I noticed this week? Every SaaS demo now includes an AI assistant. It's a lot. Are we actually in the middle of an enterprise AI revolution or just a very aggressive marketing cycle?
It feels like a genuine inflection point, Maya, although the marketing noise definitely obscures the signal. We're seeing a fundamental shift in how software is used and potentially built, driven by these AI agents. The key isn't just automation, it's the potential to erode the traditional software value chain, and that's why everyone from Amazon to Constellation Software is scrambling.
Erode feels strong. Constellation's whole business model is maintenance and support, right? The bear case is that AI kills the need for both, but Daniel Monk pointed out that represents 75% of their revenue. Doesn't that provide a surprisingly robust defense?
It does initially, but the threat isn't necessarily complete elimination. It's a significant reduction in the scale of those teams. Think about it, if AI can handle 80% of basic support requests, Constellation still collects the revenue, but their margins change dramatically. The more compelling question, though, is Constellation's ability to actually build those AI agents effectively. Their decentralized structure, while historically an advantage, could be a massive hurdle.
Data silos. That's the phrase, isn't it? ServiceNow, with its unified platform, suddenly looks a lot more appealing for AI development. It's like Constellation is running a network of really efficient but isolated software shops.
Two things stand out. It's the difference between forging a single high-strength steel beam from a controlled alloy and trying to weld together a bunch of disparate metal scraps. The consistency and predictability of the alloy, a unified data platform in this case, matters enormously. The current AI infrastructure simply requires consolidation of data, something Constellation isn't geared for.
Okay, that's a good analogy. But what about the big players? Salesforce, Amazon, they're not immune to disruption. Bill Gurley said Salesforce customers barely scratch the surface of their product capabilities.
That's a critical vulnerability. Insourcing, building customized systems instead of paying for unused features represents a real risk. The Fortune 500 has the resources and incentive to bypass Salesforce's subscription model, a scenario far less likely for smaller businesses. But Salesforce's ecosystem scale is a significant counterweight. They have the data to train powerful agents and the existing customer relationships to deploy them.
So scale is the key differentiator. Amazon seems particularly well-positioned then. The robotics implementation is more than just cost savings. Clay Fink said it's a fundamental shift.
Stepping back, the $9 to $14 billion annual savings from fulfillment are just the tip of the iceberg. The automation of a million-person workforce is almost inevitable. But more importantly, Amazon's ecosystem, AWS Bedrock, Rufus internal improvements, gives them an unparalleled data advantage and control over the entire AI investment cycle. It's a self-reinforcing loop.
And that's why everyone is focused on enterprise coding. Anthropic's growth is outpacing OpenAI's, and it's not just about user acquisition. Brad Gerstner is predicting $80 to $100 billion in revenue by 2026, driven by consistent metered usage.
That's the crucial point. The subscription model is proving less reliable than the enterprise willingness to pay for demonstrable value. OpenAI's initial focus on consumer AI, while generating headlines, left them vulnerable to Anthropic's enterprise-first strategy. It's about predictable revenue streams, not viral growth.
Predictable revenue. But even that's not guaranteed. Chamath Palihapitiy repeatedly emphasized there's not one great example yet of a truly profitable enterprise AI solution despite all the investment.
The hype has likely outstripped reality. The initial wave of investment was predicated on the assumption that AI would immediately translate to significant cost savings and increased efficiency. The reality is more complex. Take Travis Kalanick's point about change management. The biggest bottleneck isn't the software itself, but navigating complex organizational structures and internal resistance.
So it's not a tech problem, it's a people problem. A lot of middle managers suddenly finding their jobs are redundant.
Worth noting, it's fundamentally a problem of organizational psychology. And that's where these digital employees come in. The trend toward building complex AI-run organizations, 20% of projects originating from entirely AI-run companies, suggests a shift in how work itself is being conceived.
But those digital employees keep running into walls, right? Memory management is the biggest infrastructure gap. Mies relying on 50-plus markdown files to manage agent recollections is not scalable.
It's a perfect illustration of the problem. Builders' ambitions are exceeding current capabilities. We're hitting the limits of context windows, knowledge retention, and proactive assistance. Future developments will be driven by infrastructure improvements, better memory layers, more efficient data retrieval, more robust reasoning engines.
AI agent development is bottlenecked by the infrastructure needed to give them long-term memory. That feels low-tech for a revolution.
It is.
And it highlights the importance of securing independent compute infrastructure. Hyperscalers controlling 60% of global compute capacity wield significant strategic power. They could strategically limit access to competitors, effectively kneecapping the frontier AI labs.
That's a scary thought. Anthropic's rapid growth is already being hampered by compute constraints. Chamath highlights a Friendster effect, inability to scale.
The pattern is clear. The physical limits of data centers and compute power are unavoidable. Anthropic's early decision to rely on hyperscalers may ultimately prove to be a strategic mistake. They're now in a five-alarm fire to secure their own capacity.
And that public sentiment shift, the growing negativity toward AI, could impact data center approvals, slowing progress even further.
It's a real concern. But the enterprise coding space continues to show promise regardless. That's why OpenAI is aggressively expanding Codex with 111 plugin integrations, attempting to regain market share.
But plugins feel like a workaround, right? Anthropic's Cloud Code offers more seamless integration.
Initially, yes.
But OpenAI's plugin ecosystem represents a potentially significant advantage in the long run, broader compatibility, greater flexibility, and a more diverse user base. And both companies are moving up the stack, owning entire workflows, Anthropic with agentic plugins, OpenAI with tools like Claude Design.
And then there's Factory, raising $150 million at a $1.5 billion valuation despite competition from OpenAI and Anthropic. Demonstrates a specific market gap.
secure and compliant AI coding tools for enterprise environments. VCs recognize the value of niche specialization within a crowded space. General-purpose tools don't cut it for heavily regulated industries.
Okay, so let's zoom out. If AI agents are really this disruptive, what does it mean for software pricing? Switching costs. Constellation's entire value proposition.
It's a fundamental reevaluation of how value is delivered. AI agents potentially reduce switching costs by making it easier to migrate data and workflows. But simultaneously, they increase the value of platforms with robust data ecosystems and integrated AI capabilities. The companies that own the AI workflow will be the winners.
And that's why Amazon and Salesforce are relatively well-positioned.
There's a signal here. They have the scale, the data, and the existing customer relationships to deploy powerful agents and maintain control over the ecosystem. But the shift toward monothreading, maintaining a single, persistent conversation, is crucial for unlocking new levels of agentic task execution.
Nick Bauman's work teammate Thread, synthesizing information from Slack, Gmail, PRs. That sounds ambitious.
It is, but it's achievable. And it embodies the idea of an AI chief of staff, handling broader knowledge work, automating complex tasks, proactively assisting users.
But the benchmarks, standardized tests aren't the right metric, right?
So here's the picture. The novel use cases they enable are far more important. Nick Bauman's Thread is his benchmark, a system that filters noise and identifies priorities, a task previously unfeasible.
And Claude 4.7 is deliberately focusing on broad capability improvements rather than a single niche area like coding.
That's the impression. A broader vision for AI as a general-purpose assistant rather than just a coding tool. But the usability change, delegation over micromanagement, is critical. Claude 4.7 performs better when treated as a capable engineer, given a full task definition up front.
So less hand-holding, more trust.
The data tells a story. Even with those improvements, there's a lingering question of code quality. Acceptance rates drop significantly over time with continued use, from 80 to 90% to 10 to 30% after 2 weeks.
9.4 times higher code churn for AI users versus non-AI users. That's not the productivity boost everyone's talking about.
We can trace that further. Measuring ROI should prioritize merged and shipped code, not raw code generation volume. The initial hype may be overblown.
We're building these incredibly powerful agents, but they still require significant human oversight. That's a humbling thought.
It is.
And it raises a fundamental question about the future of software development. Will AI agents augment human capabilities or ultimately replace them? I don't think we know. And that uncertainty, the potential for organizational friction, the limitations of infrastructure, the risk of compute constraints, that's what makes this so fascinating. We're at the very beginning of this revolution, and the path forward is far from clear.
It feels like we've built the engine, but haven't figured out what the car is actually for. And if it turns out that car needs a driver, well, that shifts the entire valuation picture. Which brings us to the stress tests coming in the financial system, doesn't it? Credit tightening and real estate risks are going to add another layer of complexity to this AI investment cycle. Chris Whalen said banks can absorb a 20 to 30% loss in private credit. Does that sound reassuring to anyone?
Not particularly, because that figure glosses over where the actual risk concentration lies. The $4 trillion in non-depository financial institution exposures is a broad number, but the key vulnerability isn't the total. It's the $500 billion in direct lending to private equity-backed companies, specifically those lacking clear paths to recovery.
So it's not the size of the problem, it's what kind of problem it is. We're talking about loans with questionable underwriting, right?
Consider this, the opacity around these loans is the real issue. Banks are strategically selling credit risk through special purpose vehicles, ostensibly to position themselves for safer assets, but this reduces transparency and creates a situation reminiscent of the pre-2008 financial crisis with off-balance sheet vehicles. It's a deliberate obscuring of exposure, and smaller banks likely lack the expertise to adequately assess the true danger.
Which means when things go south, and they are going south, there's limited independent verification of investment grade ratings. CD claiming entirely investment grade feels optimistic.
It's a significant blind spot. These valuations rely heavily on sponsor assessments, which lack mandatory disclosure requirements. We're essentially operating in a black box with a systemic reliance on potentially biased reporting. Consider Red Lobster as a prime example. Involuntary conversion of equity to debt is becoming more common as sponsors are forced to write down valuations.
Let's talk about commercial real estate. The narrative is losses are contained. What's the reality?
The contained narrative is misleading. Losses are happening, but they are largely hidden in private investments. You have to dig into specialized publications like The Real Deal to see the discrepancies between reported valuations and actual sale prices and concessions. Banks are intentionally focusing on premium assets, leaving the riskier exposures to the CMBS market and private investors.
So major institutions are minimizing headline risk while the rot spreads elsewhere. I'm starting to feel like a financial archaeologist.
That's a fair analogy. This strategy means the pain is primarily visible in non-public REITs and through industry-specific data, creating a distorted perception of the overall health of the sector. The lack of public reporting is a crucial component of the issue.
And the credit card numbers. They're still high. I saw $4 of unused credit for every dollar used.
That's another warning sign, suggesting potential vulnerability in consumer debt. We're also seeing credit loss reserves increase, specifically within the bottom quartile of households by income, diverging from the overall downward trend in credit losses.
Okay, let's paint a picture. Banks sell off risky credit, valuations are questionable, commercial real estate is a mess they're not admitting to, and people are racking up credit card debt. If I follow this correctly, what happens next?
If the downturn worsens, the SPVs become the focal point. As losses materialize in private credit and CRE, those vehicles face margin calls and potential defaults. This could trigger a cascade effect, forcing banks to reassess their exposures, potentially exceeding the 20 to 30% absorption capacity Whalen mentioned.
Banks are essentially hoping the SPVs don't blow up while simultaneously hoping the sponsors can keep valuations afloat. A delicate balancing act.
And it's a particularly risky balance because the valuation problem isn't going away. Independent verification is lacking, and the potential for involuntary equity conversions remains high. The flow of capital into real estate sectors positioning for a downturn suggests the market anticipates further weakness, but BDCs are currently the least attractive entry point given the lack of transparency.
Let's say we're looking at April 2025. What's the most likely outcome in commercial real estate?
By April 2025, we will likely see a more pronounced reckoning in the non-premium CRE segments, particularly office spaces and regional malls. The initial wave of hidden losses will become increasingly visible through sale data and REIT performance, forcing wider recognition of the underlying problems. Expect a contraction in lending to CRE as banks tighten standards and reassess collateral values.
And banks, specifically the smaller ones?
The regional banks with significant, unmanaged exposure to private credit through these SPVs are the most vulnerable. We could see increased scrutiny from regulators, potential downgrades, and even failures if losses exceed their capacity.
Okay, deadpan time. If this all goes sideways, first, my local coffee shop will start accepting Bitcoin. Second, my apartment building will be foreclosed on by a Japanese pension fund. And third, the Red Lobster mascot will be appointed to the Federal Reserve.
The third one is unexpectedly specific.
It felt right. But seriously, summarizing this, who wins, who loses, or what breaks next?
The clear losers are investors in opaque private credit vehicles and REITs, especially those reliant on sponsor valuations. Regional banks lacking sophisticated risk management are highly vulnerable. What breaks next isn't necessarily the entire financial system, but the illusion of stability in the private credit market. Expect a wave of downgrades, restructurings, and a fundamental reassessment of risk pricing starting in late 2024, intensifying through the first half of 2025. This crisis of confidence in valuation models extends directly into the broader fintech space, particularly DeFi projects reliant on accurate asset backing, which brings us to crypto's regulatory hurdles and ecosystem vulnerabilities.
Remember that thread about the sheer audacity of some ICO pitches? It feels directly related to the regulatory mess Laura Shin navigated with BitClout and DSO.
It's a telling detail. Shin's experience illustrates a fundamental issue. Early-stage crypto projects operate in a legal gray area, and the optics of financial flows, even when compliant, can trigger disproportionate scrutiny. The DOJ case dismissal in March 2025 hinged on demonstrating clear accounting practices, despite the project intentionally lacking a corporate entity to promote decentralization.
It's like trying to explain to your landlord why your rent payment went through 7 different Venmo accounts before landing in their bank. They don't care about your principles, just the weirdness of the transaction.
And the SEC case against DSO, dismissed with prejudice in March 2026, highlights a deeper problem, potential anti-crypto bias. Her lawyers described the case as weak, and Shin refused a settlement, believing it was baseless, attributing the shift to pro-crypto candidates aided by Brian Armstrong's Fair Shake PAC.
The SEC spent a year investigating something they likely knew was flimsy.
The internal advocacy up the chain, presenting to over a dozen officials, suggests resistance, not bureaucratic delay. They even misrepresented her spending, classifying office rent as personal expenses. It demonstrates the lasting impact of initial accusations and the difficulty of full reputational repair.
But it wasn't just the SEC. Taylor Monahan and Kyne Warwick point to systemic vulnerabilities in Bitcoin itself, like token lock structures giving early investors limited recourse when issuers fail.
The pattern is clear: the proposed BIP-361 to freeze Satoshi's coins, while potentially genius, creates a forcing function for disclosure. A hard deadline for upgrades means Satoshi would have to move the coins to remain in control, potentially exposing their identity.
A 15-year anonymity run ending with a god candle price event. The drama.
The proposed timeline of 3 to 5 years introduces prolonged market anxiety. Moreover, even if the coins aren't stolen, passive acceptance of a lockup represents a significant risk, as Warwick notes. The inability to definitively prove ownership, even with these upgrades, is a core problem.
It's all very precarious. What happens when you layer on platform risk, like Scroll's fee hikes or X's policy changes?
Warwick calls platform risk the most significant danger. He draws a parallel to Farmville on Facebook, disproportionate power over projects built within them. The lack of transparency surrounding terms creates perpetual distrust. And sending stablecoins to early projects completely unprotected. He sent $80,000 to Shane from Pala Market without a formal agreement.
$80,000. It seems like the entire ecosystem operates on a foundation of optimistic assumptions.
That's a key tension.
Investors often dismiss unfavorable terms expecting future gains, leaving them with limited recourse. The 2025 ICO investor Warwick spoke with thought we were going to keep winning, they wouldn't need the money. These structural weaknesses, combined with the regulatory uncertainty, create a volatile environment. Looking ahead, the key will be observing how the interplay between regulatory pressure, evolving security threats like quantum computing, and platform consolidation shapes the next phase of crypto adoption. Specifically, watching the legal outcomes of Curve's ongoing battles, the Magic Beans cases, will set a critical precedent for investor rights.
So, distilling everything down, it feels like we've been tracing the symptoms of a really fundamental recalibration. Energy, finance, software, all seemingly distinct, yet undeniably interconnected. Jamie Smyth's report of a substantial physical shortage of oil, impacting 20% of global supply, isn't just an energy story, it's a geopolitical pressure point that ripples through everything, from inflation expectations to the viability of private equity deals. And those deals with $500 billion tied to PE-backed companies are now facing the scrutiny of tightening credit conditions.
Something to flag here, what's emerging is a pattern of constrained resources, not just oil, but compute capital and even trust. The AI revolution, for example, is predicated on exponential growth, but Chamath's point that we haven't seen a truly profitable enterprise application feels significant. It's as if the system is hitting internal limits. We saw this with Anthropic's growth, outpacing OpenAI, but the question remains if that growth can be sustained without fundamental shifts in the infrastructure supporting it. It's like attempting to solve a complex equation with an incomplete set of variables.
And that infrastructure constraint feeds directly into the financial risks. Chris Whalen suggesting banks can absorb a 20 to 30% loss in private credit feels like a polite nod to stability, but the $4 trillion in non-depository financial institution exposures lurking beneath the surface, well, Red Lobster's involuntary conversion tells a different story. It's a lack of transparency, a black box situation that leaves us vulnerable to cascading failures.
It's a system attempting to optimize for efficiency. Constellation's 75% recurring revenue from maintenance is a prime example, but at the cost of resilience. The focus on squeezing every ounce of profit out of existing structures creates fragility. And then you throw crypto into the mix, a space riddled with legal ambiguities, as we saw with the DSO case dismissed with prejudice, and you're left with a very unstable foundation. The proposed BIP-361 upgrade to potentially reveal Satoshi's coins is interesting. Will it reinforce trust or trigger a new wave of volatility?
The Middle Eastern sovereign wealth funds continuing to deploy capital globally feels like a rational response to this instability. A search for safe havens and strategic assets. But that also suggests a further concentration of power and potential for political influence. Are we seeing a preemptive consolidation of resources in anticipation of something?
I think the unresolved tension is the Fed's response. Tightening policy despite a global energy shock feels counterintuitive and frankly carries significant risk. Ultimately, these aren't isolated events. They're facets of a larger system under stress, and the question isn't whether something will break, but where and when.
It feels like we're all financial archaeologists, digging through layers of debt and dependencies, trying to understand the true extent of the exposure. It's a complex puzzle.
And one where the pieces are constantly shifting. Thanks for joining us today. We'll continue to unpack these developments tomorrow.